This next story is for those who are seeing in the stock market turmoil a threat to their own retirement. We're going to get some investment tips from David Swensen. He's famous for how he's managed Yale University's money. Last year, Swensen made Yale a 28% return, adding a whopping $5 billion to the university's endowment. And that wasn't a fluke. Over the past two decades, Swensen's record is better than any university, foundation, or pension fund. NPR's Chris Arnold has more.
If you want to make the most money you can for retirement, David Swensen is your friend. He recently took the time to research and write a book to give advice to everyday people. First, he says, in scary economic times like this, you shouldn't trust your instincts.
The human tendency in this kind of environment is to do something, to make a change.
Stocks seem risky. They've been falling. So Swensen says most people he talks to get nervous and want to sell stocks.
And that's exactly the wrong reaction. Buying high and selling low is not a way to make money. It's not hard, right? Very simple. You want to do the opposite.
Swensen says you should have the right long-term mix of stock index funds, bonds, real estate investment trusts, adjusted according to your age. We've got his advice on that at NPR.org. But say when stocks tank, that mix gets out of balance. You used to have, say, 30% of your holdings in U.S. stocks. Now it's 29 or 28%. So you rebalance by shifting more holdings into stock index funds.
Volatility has been so extreme that there have been a couple instances where we've traded pretty significant volumes, tens of millions of dollars.
That's in a single day. If stocks fall, Yale's endowment is buying them. On some days, the market's turned around and come roaring back up to where it started, and then Swensen's sold stocks.
And made in excess of $1 million. So you end up at the same place that you started, except $1 million ahead. That's not bad. But from rebalancing, not from speculating, simply sticking with your long-term targets.
That's the takeaway. The stock market can end up flat, but you've still made money because you rebalanced when it was down. Sure, sometimes the market keeps going down, but over time, 5 years, 10, 20 years, you figure the market will eventually keep rising. And Swensen says you will goose out substantial extra returns by rebalancing along the way.
Free bonus.
Now, back to that mix of what you should own. Here, Swensen says that people are constantly bombarded with the wrong messages.
But powerful dreams need more than just a little weekend gardening.
Start with your dreams and your Ameriprise financial advisor through a unique approach to financial planning.
We called Jim Barnash with Ameriprise Financial. He's the National Director of Financial Planning. He says, especially in volatile markets like this, people need quality one-on-one advice to make sure they're properly diversified. We asked him what the fees are at Ameriprise for that advice.
They're in a range from 40 basis points on up to in excess of 1.25%.
Okay, and I'm just busting up my calculator here. Let's say somebody's, I don't know, in their late 40s, early 50s, they've made some money, they got $500,000 in their retirement 401k, 1.25%. So that right there, that's going to cost them $6,250 a year for the Ameriprise fees. And then on top of that, they'll be paying fees for the different mutual funds that they're in?
It's very possible if you're using mutual funds.
Over 20 years, that person is losing hundreds of thousands of dollars because of fees. Of course, that's better than not investing at all, and a lot of people want an advisor to help them. But Swensen says most of these investment services provide pretty mediocre advice, and it's just not worth giving them a percentage of your life savings.
That's the wrong path. And the reason it's the wrong path is it's a very, very expensive path.
Swensen says fees are also the big reason you should buy index funds instead of classic mutual funds. The index funds, which track market segments like the S&P 500, are a lot cheaper. Swensen says the vast majority of professional mutual fund managers fail to beat those indexes.
I mean, when you look at the results on an after-fee, after-tax basis over reasonably long periods of time, there's almost no chance that you end up beating an index fund.
The odds, he says, are 100 to 1. Swensen's last bit of advice, don't try to pick individual stocks and go with nonprofit funds like Vanguard. There, too, the lower fees will mean more money in your pocket over time. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. And now it's time for Your Health. And in this part of the program, we'll hear about consulting your doctor online. Some insurance plans will pay for that. But first, we're going to hear something about what you might call hydration hype. We've all heard we're supposed to keep healthy by drinking 8 glasses of water per day, but a new analysis turns a critical eye on that old advice. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
It's not that everyone follows the recommendation to drink 8 glasses of water a day, but a lot of people seem to think it's a good idea. I spoke to a bunch of commuters who ride the train into Washington each day.
Well, I guess it's an essential, yes.
I don't see that it can hurt you.
And I see you've got your water right here tucked into your knapsack.
Absolutely. I think it's good for the skin and for your system.
Tracy Hummer's getting at a common assumption here. It's that all this water helps to clear the gunk or toxins from our bodies. That's an appealing concept, says physician Stanley Goldfarb, a kidney expert at the University of Pennsylvania. He explains that the kidneys do filter toxins from the bloodstream and clear them out of the body.
So the question is, does drinking more water increase this normal, important function of the kidneys? And the answer is no. In fact, drinking large amounts of water actually, and surprisingly, tends to reduce the kidney's ability to function as a filter. It's a subtle decline, but definite.
Goldfarb says it's not exactly clear why this happens. The going theory is that drinking lots of water may stimulate a part of the nervous system, and this appears to slightly constrict the blood vessels that lead to the kidneys.
That probably is the mechanism of this slight fall.
Goldfarb explains if you take a 200-pound man, a full 120 pounds of his body is already water. So could drinking a few extra glasses each day on top of what's consumed in food or other beverages really have measurable effects, say, on the quality of your skin?
In reality, it's such a tiny part of the amount of water that's in the body that it's very, very unlikely that one is getting any benefit from that.
So for everyone in the habit of hauling around their Nalgene bottles or buying loads of bottled water, is it worth all the fuss? University of Pittsburgh's Madeline Fernstrom says it may be, particularly if you're trying to lose weight.
Water's a great strategy for dieters because it has no calories, so you can keep your mouth busy without food and get the sense of satisfaction.
Fernstrom says, as for the amount, there's nothing special about drinking 8 glasses, nor is there anything magical about water alone. She says other zero-calorie options, such as diet sodas, are fine too. Dr. Stanley Goldfarb is not sold on the diet argument. He points out that researchers who've studied this have come up with conflicting results.
There were some studies that suggested that, in fact, caloric intake was reduced when individuals were given water prior to eating. Other studies suggested that it wasn't.
So on this issue, you may be the best judge of whether drinking more helps you eat less. As for people just hoping to feel better, some may take Bill Salvatore's approach. He's one of the commuters we heard from earlier who says drinking a little extra water can't hurt you.
It's just going to make you go to the bathroom a lot more, that's all.
Goldfarb agrees. He says a few people may benefit from extra fluids, for example, those with kidney stones. And certainly athletes and hikers know it's important to avoid dehydration. But for the most part, Goldfarb says, people shouldn't worry about how much water they've had to drink each day. His advice? Just drink when you're thirsty. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Athletes actually run the risk of overhydration, and you can read about that at npr.org/yourhealth.
One new way, and possibly more efficient way, to get your doctor's advice or make an appointment is to go online. And more doctors are going online to communicate with their patients. That's because this year, the nation's biggest health insurers, Aetna and Cigna, start reimbursing for a service that provides secure web visits between patients and their doctors. From San Francisco, Deirdre Kennedy reports.
At his office near downtown Oakland, internist Dr. Dean Nichols checks secured online messages from his patients throughout the day.
So this is a patient who had a recent diagnosis of a relatively rare condition called polymyalgia rheumatica and is being treated with steroids and had some questions regarding the management of this problem.
In the past, finding a patient's chart, reading through it, and then reaching the patient by phone might have taken days. Not anymore. Nichols gets messages through a secure portal from a wide variety of people, homebound elders, students away at school, and workers with busy schedules. It's changed the way he manages his patient load.
Rather than being interrupted while I'm seeing a patient, I can handle my email messages from patients either before office hours, after office hours, over the noon hour. So it really actually frees me up to spend more time with patients.
By logging into a secure web-based service called Relay Health, Dr. Nichols' patients can request an appointment, ask for a referral, or get a prescription refill, or they can sign up for what's called a web visit. Retired oncologist Joseph Halperin and his wife Lynn are both patients of Dr. Nichols. They often sign on for web visits to get feedback on minor conditions.
For example, my wife had the flu. She coughed quite a bit, then developed a pain that she thought was either a crack rib or a muscle strain. And we didn't think it required a visit because we didn't think there could be anything done about that kind of condition, but just wanted some reassurance about that.
So what did Dr. Nichols end up telling you?
He said it's probably a strain and it should go away within a week to 10 days, which it did.
Email between physicians and patients is nothing new, but concerns over privacy issues, getting unedited ramblings from patients, and lack of reimbursement made many doctors reluctant to e-chat. Now major health plans are paying for the online visits through Relay Health, and the company's secure portal serves as an electronic advice nurse that helps focus the online inquiry to the doc, Relay's general manager Ken Tarkoff.
It's an online interview with branching logic based on a variety of questions that the system asks the patient to provide answers to, and based on those answers, it provides additional questions.
Questions such as, how long have you been experiencing this symptom? Do you have a fever? Have you taken any medication? How is it working? Questions designed by a team of physician advisors. The online communication then becomes part of the patient's record. This year, health insurers Aetna and Cigna started aggressively marketing the service to more than 1 million physicians across the country. Cigna spokesman Joe Mondi says e-visits benefit physicians, employers, and patients because it only costs $25.
There's a substantial savings there. In addition to that cost savings, there's also, of course, the time saving, which is a value to really all three of them.
But not all physicians have confidence in the technology. Cardiologist Jim Rohack is on the board of the American Medical Association. He's concerned about the security of online communication.
Once you put things in cyberspace, they can go all over the place. At least with a telephone, you know, even with a cell phone, you pretty much it's a one-on-one conversation.
And he says there are times when online communication between doctor and patient is not appropriate.
Any time where a physical examination has to be done to make a diagnosis, the person's having chest pain, for example, it's very difficult to make the determination over email whether or not the person's having a heart attack or not.
But Tarkoff of Relay Health is confident that patients and physicians are capable of making that judgment call.
It's not right for every situation. It's an additional thing that you can offer to patients where it's appropriate for patients who understand how to use it effectively and where the physicians are comfortable that those patients can provide the information over the web.
Patients are always advised to seek urgent care if they have symptoms like chest pain, a high fever, or uncontrolled bleeding. Americans do seem to be eager to adopt the technology. A recent Harris Interactive survey of online users found that 74% of patients would like to be able to communicate with their doctors through some sort of email. For NPR News, I'm Deirdre Kennedy in San Francisco.
Forty years ago today, Martin Luther King Jr. spoke to a crowd gathered in a church in Memphis. It would turn out to be the night before he was assassinated. A thunderstorm was swirling outside. The shutters banged against the walls. Still, the hall was packed.
If something isn't done and done in a hurry to bring the colored peoples of the world out of their long years of poverty, their long years of hurt and neglect, the whole world is doomed.
This last speech came to be known as the Mountaintop Speech. And over the next few days, we're going to meet a few of the people who were there. The Reverend Samuel Billy Kiles was one of them. He was a friend of King's and the pastor of the Monumental Baptist Church in Memphis, which he still leads today. The Reverend Kiles joins us from Memphis, and thank you for being on the program.
It's my pleasure.
Will you please put us into the moment. What was Martin Luther King doing in your city that April of 1968?
The garbage workers had gone on strike in Memphis. Their working conditions were so bad. And the leadership really tried to get them to go back and wait until the summer when you have the flies and stench and all that. But they simply refused to go back. They said no. Out of that came a very powerful sign that became a symbol. It didn't say freedom. It didn't say justice. All it said was, I am a man. And they were treated less than men. And when you really get a movement going, you know when it's time to send for Martin Luther King.
King covered a lot of ground in this speech, from the broad sweep of world history to the striking garbage men there in Memphis. But then the speech builds to what feels eerie now and certainly a prophetic conclusion. Tell us about that.
There have been so many death threats against his life, especially since he had come out against the war in Vietnam. But he talked about death more that night than we'd heard him talk about it in a long while. He talked about the stabbing, the demented black woman who came up to him in Harlem. He was autographing books and said, are you Martin Luther King? He said, yes. He never looked up. He was autographing books. She reached over the table and plunged a letter opener into his chest. And when he was recovering, he said he does remember a teenage girl who wrote, Dear Dr. King, I read about your misfortune, and I'm so sorry. The newspaper said the blade of the letter opener was so close to your aorta that if you had sneezed, you would have drowned in your own blood. And she put at the bottom, I'm so glad you didn't sneeze. And he took up on that and did a whole litany. And I'm glad I didn't sneeze. If I had sneezed, I would have missed the Selma to Montgomery march. If I had sneezed, I would have missed the young people sitting in all over the South for their rights.
If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been here in 1963. The black people of Birmingham, Alabama, aroused the conscience of this nation and brought into being the Civil Rights Bill. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have had a chance later that year in August to try to tell America about a dream that I had had. If I had sneezed.
By that time, we were on our feet. Many of us, grown men, were crying. We didn't know why we were crying. We had no way of knowing that would be the last speech of his life. And then he took us to the mountaintop. He said, I may not get there with you, but you'll get to the promised land. Because God has allowed me to go up on the mountain, and I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. And I am so certain he knew he wouldn't get there, but he wouldn't tell us that. That would have been too heavy for us. So he softened it. And tonight, he closes out by saying, tonight I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the coming of the glory of the Lord. And we had to help him to his seat behind that powerful prophetic speech.
Hmm. Do you remember what you were thinking at that moment that the speech ended?
It was like I said, he preached himself through the fear of death. He just got it out of him. He just dealt with it. I mean, it was like, what did he know that we didn't know?
40 years is a biblical number of years, a passage to have crossed. Here you are 40 years later. What is it like to listen to this speech today?
I don't know. I don't even know how to process. It's been 40 years. I take issue with those people who say, oh, it's worse now than it was then. The only reason you can say that is because you were not here then.
And, of course, if Martin Luther King Jr. were alive today, he'd be 79 years old, and he would see that a black man has a realistic chance to become the next president of the United States.
And my heart leaps for joy to see it. Think of how far we had to come. It was illegal for my ancestors to know how to read during slavery, illegal to know how to read. Came to this country in chains. And we go from that, my goodness, to the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, born and raised in Birmingham, Alabama. And then I can see cities that have African-American mayors and, my God, governors, my goodness. And I travel the length and breadth of this country as a witness, speaking to young people who were not born and their parents were children, letting them know that the dream, we're not going to get to the place where we say, Dr. King's dream has been realized, now we can go to the beach. That's not going to happen. Much of it has been realized, but there is so much to do. But each generation will have its portion, and that helps to keep the dream alive.
Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
The Reverend Samuel Billy Kiles is pastor of Monumental Baptist Church in Memphis, Tennessee. He was with Martin Luther King Jr. when he delivered his last speech 40 years ago today, and he was with King one day later when he was gunned down at the Lorraine Motel. You can see a video excerpt of King's final speech at NPR.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. The latest mass grounding of commercial airliners was guaranteed to get the media's attention. United Airlines parked dozens of Boeing 777 aircraft for inspection. The affected planes include one chartered to carry reporters on President Bush's trip to Europe.
United's action comes after American and Delta canceled hundreds of flights. Southwest Airlines was accused of faking inspections on its planes. And now the Federal Aviation Administration is investigating four major airlines.
It fell to Acting Administrator Robert Sturgill to offer the reassurance to flyers that has become a ritual at times like this.
The bottom line, despite what a small few may imply, is that our system works and that flying is safer today than at any time in the past.
None of which will make the story you're about to hear any less startling. We've heard about these problems because two FAA inspectors blew the whistle. Today they testify before Congress, and they've already told their story to NPR's Wade Goodwin.
If you're cruising along at 37,000 feet in a 25-year-old 737, Bobby Boutrous is the kind of FAA safety inspector you hope checked out your airplane. He's a stickler for details and relentless when he discovers a serious safety problem. Back in 2003, Boutrous had been assigned responsibility for reviewing the engine maintenance for 737s in his region. And Boutrous says when he looked at Southwest Airlines paperwork, it was so inconsistent and incomplete, he couldn't tell what was going on with their engines.
In 2003, I had found a lot of inconsistencies with the records. They were different from aircraft to aircraft, and it was very hard to determine compliance.
Boutrous complained to his supervisor, but he says he was largely ignored. But when Boutrous was named program manager for the Boeing 737-700 series in 2006, the situation came to a head. Now he was responsible for the safety of the entire aircraft, and Boutrous says Southwest record-keeping had not improved.
I went back to my supervisor and I stated to him that I had the same problems I had back in 2003, 3 years earlier on the engines, and I want to send a letter of investigation. He refused to.
An FAA letter of investigation is a serious matter for an airline, and according to FAA rules, under these particular circumstances, Boutrous was required to investigate further. But he says he was again blocked by his supervisor, Douglas Gawodzinski. Boutrous says he thinks he knows why. Gawodzinski had a friend at Southwest.
Mr. Paul Como, he was an FAA inspector in our office. While working for the FAA, he accepted a position with Southwest Airlines as the manager for regulatory compliance. So anything that he had to do with aircraft maintenance, it was dealt between Mr. Gawodzinski and Mr. Como. They had a very close relationship.
Douglas Gawodzinski and Paul Como did not respond to NPR's request for comment. With a former FAA insider heading up their compliance team, Boutrous says Southwest Airlines became complacent and arrogant. But Boutrous wouldn't go away, so Southwest tried to get him removed. They told the FAA they wanted a different inspector.
It was obvious that the Southwest Airlines, to me, what I believe, they were trying to cherry-pick the inspector for the inspection. And because of my knowledge for 3 years, they want me not to perform this inspection, they want somebody else.
At first, Boutros's supervisor refused to remove him, but it wasn't long before Gawodzinski told Boutros he was out and his career was in jeopardy because there had been undisclosed complaints from anonymous Southwest officials. And this is where the second FAA whistleblower, Douglas Peters, comes into the story, because he was asked to review Boutros's Southwest investigation, and the more Peters investigated, the more he agreed with Boutros that the flying public was in danger.
Absolutely, and so did the manager, and so did the assistant manager, and so did the supervisor for the geographic unit. It defies logic that something so critical would be not addressed. I can't explain it. It's a mystery.
Peter says he soon discovered that Southwest began to try to interfere with his investigation as well by going behind his back, again to FAA supervisor Gawodzinski. But the situation for Southwest was about to change. In March of 2007, the airline reported to the FAA that it had not done the required fuselage inspections on 47 jets. That's important because certain versions of the Boeing 737 are vulnerable to cracks just above and below the windows. In fact, in 1988, an Aloha Airlines 737 explosively decompressed and blew out 18 feet of its roof. A flight attendant was sucked out to her death, and it was something of a miracle the pilots could even land the plane. The pictures are not to be believed. But instead of grounding these 47 aircraft and inspecting them for cracks in the skin, Southwest quietly continued to fly these jets. And FAA Inspector Gawodzinski, who knew about Southwest's alleged deception, is accused of helping the airline cover it up. Whistleblower Doug Peters says the problem at the FAA involves more than one rogue supervisor. He says higher-ups in the agency have known for 3 years that there were serious problems with aircraft maintenance inspections and have done nothing.
Long story short, it didn't have to come to this. The FAA could have addressed this a long time ago. And the reason that we're here today is because they failed to do so.
Yesterday, the FAA tried to do some damage control. The agency has transferred Supervisor Gawodzinski and fined Southwest $10 million. Bobby Sturgill is the acting FAA administrator.
We had a breakdown in the system with Southwest Airlines. There is no excuse. We have taken appropriate personnel action in-house. The most important outcome is that we learned from the experience and strengthened our system to reduce the likelihood of a reoccurrence. And for those who question our commitment to safety, I would suggest there's at least one airline today with 10.2 million reasons why those critics are simply wrong.
For its part, Southwest Airlines at first protested the $10 million fine. Then the company fell silent as the extent of the public relations mess became apparent. Ginger Harnage, Senior Vice President, says the company is investigating.
We put three employees on administrative leave. We really accelerated this internal audit even further. We brought in an outside expert, and also the FAA is coming in with a separate independent audit.
Southwest declined to comment about any of the details regarding its past interactions with the FAA. It will not be a pleasant day for Southwest executives or FAA officials appearing before the House Transportation Committee and its angry chairman, Jim Oberstar. The FAA announcement that four more airlines are now under investigation for failing to comply with federal maintenance regulations only serves to underscore Bobby Boutros's contention that many other FAA investigators have been stymied by their supervisors, too. Boutros says how Congress reacts to this will determine a lot about future aircraft safety.
I want to tell you, we have gotten the support from a lot of fellow inspectors that they're going through the same thing I went through for the last 5 years. So I think the flying public needs to know that we need their support. This way we can do what we're hired for.
In the last few days, Bobby Boutros received a death threat for his role as a whistleblower. The FBI says it is investigating. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. In Oregon, archaeologists have found something they say is very exciting. 14,000-year-old fossilized excrement. Now, stay with me here. These coprolites, as they're called by the experts, are remarkable for several reasons. For one thing, they're older than most artifacts left by the earliest Americans. For another, they contain DNA, and that gives scientists a rare opportunity to learn about the people who left them behind. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
Archaeologists knew about Oregon's Paisley Caves back in the late 1930s. They were shallow and were carved into a hillside by a prehistoric lake. Inside, animal bones and stone tools and other signs that humans camped or lived there. But in 2002, a team dug deeper and found what you might call pay dirt.
In the bottom of cave number 5, we recovered horse and camel bones and a coprolite, which produced human DNA.
Archaeologist Janice Jenkins from the University of Oregon says they eventually found hundreds of coprolites. 6 contained human DNA. What amazed him was how old they were, 14,300 years. That radiocarbon date is important because no one has been able to agree on when people came to the Americas. The earliest clear evidence is about 13,000 years ago, but it's mostly stone tools and butchered animal bones. These were left by the Clovis people, traditionally thought of as the first Americans. But nobody had human remains that old, no bones or teeth, says Jenkins.
We finally have human remains, or cells, basically molecular evidence for human beings before the Clovis time, and they're basically the individual signature that they left.
And they left it at least 1,000 years before the Clovis people. And the DNA tells more. Eska Willerslev at the University of Copenhagen is the scientist who extracted the DNA.
Our result shows that the oldest evidence we have to date of human presence in North America is definitely of Native American origin.
Native American origin because the coprolite DNA shows certain genetic patterns called haplogroups by geneticists common to present-day Native Americans. These patterns are also found among certain people in Eastern Asia. That adds weight to the hypothesis that people first came here across the Bering Sea on a land bridge connecting the two continents. Jenkins says scientists are still teasing out more information from the fossil feces, not surprisingly, for example, what early American cuisine was like.
They certainly ate sage grouse and smaller animals. I think we've recovered some chipmunk bones from one of the coprolites.
Jenkins says there are residues in the coprolites from types of plants that still can be found near the caves.
So what we have are visitors coming for a short stay, doing some hunting and collecting. So they would have been looking out over a grassy plain, basically, with a pretty rich environment, probably a few trees here and there, junipers, some pine trees possibly, but mostly an open shrub and grassland.
There are some puzzles raised by the mix of coprolites in the cave bottom, however. Thomas Dillehay is an archaeologist at Vanderbilt University.
Some of them did not have human DNA, and others had canine, perhaps fox DNA. So those admixtures are somewhat problematic and need to be resolved in the future.
So there's a chance that the coprolites were left by canines, or at least contaminated by them. But Jenkins notes that some of the coprolites contain human hair and human proteins in addition to human DNA. He suggests that if they were left by dogs, then they were dogs that were eating humans, which doesn't change the conclusion that people lived and died there 14,300 years ago. With hundreds more coprolites to examine, genetics expert Eska Willerslev says there's lots they can still find out from the DNA.
We can actually investigate, you know, what was the diversity of the people, first people entering the Americas, how many different people were they, you know, how big was the population, how was the frequency of females versus males.
The research on the Paisley Caves coprolites appears in this week's issue of the journal Science. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.